you know, I had a long time manager, Andrew Bosworth, who, and I wrote a blog post about this because I thought it was such a great lesson he taught me. He said to me one time, he was like, "So, what's going off the rails in your team?" And I was like, "Oh, how dare you? Like, everything's perfect.
Everything's fine.
All hospital corners, nothing to see here." I don't think I actually responded that way, but I was like, "What do you mean? Like, have you heard something?" And he was like, "No, I just know, you know, if everything's going perfectly, you're probably micromanaging the team. And if you're pushing authority down to your leaders the way you need to and the way you should and the way they deserve, you know, to have those opportunities, not everything's going to go well. So I better see some things a little bit off the rails." Because if you don't delegate and you operate through micromanagement, you're going to burn out and people are going to be unhappy.
Welcome to this first episode of 2018 of the Role Models Podcast, a podcast where we interview successful and inspiring women about their personal journeys, careers, and all the valuable lessons they've learned along the way. My name is David Noel. Thank you for joining for today's episode. And whether you're just starting out in your journey or already in a senior management position, this is a conversation packed full of career and leadership advice from our guest, Margaret Stewart, who is the Vice President of product design at Facebook. For me, it's been a real joy to record this conversation with Margaret. Her knowledge, her passion, her insight into how to create workplace environments that allow people to create amazing work is invaluable. In fact, many times during our conversation, Margaret's face would light up as she described her team and the collaborative nature of their work. This is a great episode if you want to learn about how to honor the creativity inside of you and why it's okay to experiment and play around if you don't know what you want to do, or how to be a good listener and collaborate well, or if you're a manager, how you can create the conditions in your team so that people can do their best work. We also learn about Margaret's key tips for managing a team, including practicing authenticity and vulnerability as a manager, and we also hear about her advice about how to think about career progression. Shout out to our patron for this episode, Anna Carolina, who is a leadership coach based out of Berlin. You can find out more about Anna's work on truthcircles.com. As always, we love to hear from you and your feedback about the podcast, so feel free to reach out to us on Twitter at Role Models or via email, hi@rolemodels.co. This is the Role Models Podcast. This is episode 27, and please enjoy this conversation with Facebook's VP of Product Design, Margaret Stewart. Margaret, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Margaret, you're the VP product design at a company that I think everybody who's listening to this has heard about and also uses at least once a day, and that's Facebook. And you have a really interesting career that I cannot wait to dive into because you were previously also the global head of design at YouTube and have worked on design teams for Google search experiences and consumer products. And so this is a really interesting career to dive into. And I, first of all, thank you for coming on a podcast and for agreeing to, you know, to share your story with us.
Yeah, I'm really, really happy to be here and excited to take some walks down memory lane of my career.
Cool. Margaret, my first question would be, if we would ask your childhood you what job you wanted to do, would that child say, "I want to be the VP of product design at a company called Facebook"?
Well, I think that's a bit of a trick question, right? I don't think any of us saw any of this coming. There's some really amazing statistic out of the U.S. Department of Education that an incredibly high percentage of kids in kindergarten today will have jobs that don't exist today. And I think, you know, we are all an earlier chapter of that story. You know, I got into this work about a little over 20 years ago. And at the time, there were no undergraduate or graduate programs that taught people how to do interaction design for digital experiences. And certainly people were doing it in other contexts and figuring it out along the way, but definitely did not envision this path for myself. And in fact, as a child, I think every day somebody asked me, "What do I want to be when I grow up?" I had a different answer because I was a kid who had a lot of interests and passions. And I think probably in hindsight, what that showed me is it's the intersection of all these things of design, technology, the humanities, the arts, you know, all these things that actually culminate in the work that I try to do day to day. So I probably didn't understand that as a kid, and I'm still trying to figure it out as an adult. But that broad set of interest, I think, has served me well, because, you know, the work that we do changes all the time, and being curious and always being interested in learning new things is definitely part of a secret ingredient of success.
Were there times when that made you nervous, not knowing what this one exact job or profession? I think we rarely use the term profession nowadays, because, you know, in our work in the tech industry, it's not really a profession. It's more like a broad set of different skills that you apply into different contexts. So do you remember if you had moments where you were nervous about not knowing?
Yeah, you know, I come from a big family. I'm the youngest of 9 kids, and most of my older siblings had what seemed like much more straightforward paths. You know, a couple of them went to medical school, some of them were in finance. And it seemed like they knew what they wanted to do. They studied it in college, and then they went and did it. And I felt a little bit like I didn't have a rudder, and that I was supposed to have a rudder. That being said, I think my curiosity and my desire to kind of understand the world more broadly and explore different things, and also having a bit of a taste for risk, and doing things that might not pan out but could be interesting in the meantime, just led me down this more circuitous route. And, you know, I have to say, I really am grateful to my parents, because it would have been very easy for them to try to steer me onto one of these clearer, more quote unquote reliable paths, even though some of them aren't nearly as reliable as people, you know, think they might be. But, you know, because some of these disciplines have gone through a lot of change and tumult as well. But, you know, they allowed me to explore and figure it out. And it turned out really well for me, you know, to give myself that time. I think if I had forced myself into something early on, I probably would have ended up doing something that didn't make me nearly as happy, and help, you know, help me have, you know, the kind of impact I've tried to have, in the work that I do. So I think it's a mixture of, just wanting to explore, and then, having parents that supported me in doing that.
There's a few things that I want to follow up on. And the first one that comes to mind, of course, is you being the youngest of 9 kids. But before we go into that, you mentioned that, you know, for you, it was about a journey to figuring out what makes you happy. How did you, and I think this, you know, a lot of our listeners are thinking about the same way, and there's different stages of their career. How do you think about happiness in context of your career and in context of it being a long journey?
That's a good question. I think I've always been a creative person, and I get nervous when I use that term, because I revere creativity, and it always feels arrogant. It's like calling yourself an artist, or even calling yourself a designer sometimes feels strange, because there's so much to aspire to and still so much to learn. But I was always a maker when I was a kid, and I feel like I knew that I had to do something where I was going to be producing things. I didn't know what that was. I did theater for a long time, and, you know, and that was what I did in undergraduate studies. I did a lot of, you know, visual arts, and I stumbled into design. And so I knew that whatever I was going to do was going to have to be in some kind of creative field. But then I also have always had this strong need to apply that creativity and in a way that's kind of in service of other people. And that's where design entered the story. And it's the thing that I love most about design is, you know, taking all of those skills and that creativity and that desire to create experiences, but also apply it to opportunities or problems that people have in the real world, and figuring out how can we take all this technology and all this creativity and harness it to hopefully make people's lives more enjoyable, more efficient, more fulfilling, whether it's in their private lives or at work. And that I find really, really satisfying. And I think it allows me to engage in my creativity while still feeling like I'm being of service to people. And that is not to say that, I mean, I actually am hugely supportive of artists who don't aspire to do that, because I think there's an incredible role for artists to play in being, you know, the voice of truth in our society. And you don't want those voices to necessarily be in service of other people's ideas or agendas. But for me, it's that satisfying combination of creativity and service that's always made the work that I do really satisfying and makes me happy, even though it's really hard sometimes and frustrating and tiring. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm really grateful to be able to do it.
You mentioned that you, as a kid, you were always a maker. Can you describe some of the things that you made?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because of course we're in the holiday season, and I grew up and still celebrate Christmas and love the season. And something that my mom handed down to me a few years ago was apparently one holiday season I collected all the corks that were coming out of the various bottles during Thanksgiving and the time leading up to Christmas. And I secretively collected all these corks, and I collected scraps of fabric and ribbon, and I made her an entire nativity set with all of the characters made out of corks. And I dressed them in little outfits. And I mean, it's kind of a silly example, but it was one of those things where, you know, it's what can I make for the people that I love? And, you know, do something that becomes a part of a ritual that's important to us. So I still actually have that cork crash. It's, you know, kind of a family joke, but it's really like a lovely reminder of, you know, something that was the product of my hands as a child, and, you know, trying to put that creativity and combine it with thoughtfulness towards other people. So I really love that, that artifact that I have of my childhood. You know, other than that, it was like I was making puppets and putting on puppet shows, or, you know, making gifts for people, or, you know, drawing, making up stories. I think it is almost a compulsion to create. So there's just so many examples, and so many of the designers and creative people, and I'm sure you're the same way, have those stories of, you know, gotta make. And you have to listen to that, because if you, even as an adult, and, you know, you go on your professional way, whether you are in the creative field or not, you really have to honor that creativity inside of you, because I feel like we all have it, but if you're a person who is like a super maker, your soul starts to die a little bit if you don't have that outlet to make things, ideally with your hands.
So I want to talk a bit, you being the youngest kid out of nine, and this may be connected to also to what you just described of being a maker in the family, because one of the questions that I usually like to lead with on the podcast is, because it's a podcast about role models and it's called the Role Models Podcast, and we'll talk more about role models later on. But a question I'd like to ask at the beginning is usually, if you could describe or name a person or something that has influenced you early on in your childhood to define who you are today. And I think, you know, growing up with nine siblings, in a family of 11 people, that's for me at least an unusual thing. So can you talk a little bit about to what extent you being the youngest of the nine kids, and also in context of what you just described, what influenced or who influenced you? And you mentioned your parents at the beginning as well, but were there others, like to what capacity were your siblings influential in your journey?
I think so much of who I am comes from my family. That's true of so many of us. Our family of origin influences how we think, how we approach problem solving and relationships. And certainly mine is like an unusual, somewhat extreme example of a large group of people who have to, you know, figure out how to make their way in the world together. I don't because I'm the youngest, I don't remember anything other than there being 11 of us, which is very different than my older siblings. But I think that it was a very special way to grow up. I felt like there were always people around to, you know, show interest in what I was doing, or, you know, to support me. By the same token, it's a really large group of people with a bunch of different personalities and interests. And it taught me, my father likes to say it really teaches you the art of negotiation, because when there's nine of you, nobody always gets their own way. And so there's this dance that you do around, okay, you need to use the bathroom. Well, how about you use it for 5 minutes and then I get it for 5 minutes? You know what I mean? I mean, it's a simple example, but it's that notion at a very young age of understanding that you are not the center of the universe, and that there's many other people whose needs need to be met, which I think had a big influence on me. And I also feel like, you know, I have six sisters and two older brothers, so it's a very female-dominated family. And I just have a lot of remarkable older sisters who showed me in a ton of different ways, some who, you know, stayed home and cared for their children, some full-time, some who are very experienced professionals in the business world, others who started nonprofits. And I think that general environment, in addition to my parents really being pretty remarkable about getting all of us through college and assuming that we would all have, you know, careers of some sort, and that gender really wasn't a major factor in what we would choose to do, that really I could do anything. And that's a pretty amazing gift of optimism around people's potential that you can give to any child, but that I think kind of carries on into adulthood and believing, you know, in, if you will, this, you know, the idea of a growth mindset, Carol Dweck's philosophy, that, you know, if you want it bad enough, you can learn to do just about anything. And that really it's about hard work and tenacity much more than some, you know, talent that you were miraculously born with. And I think because my parents both came from, you know, blue collar working families, and my dad was first person on either side to go to college, there was this assumption that anything that was worth doing was going to be a lot of hard work. That really provided me with a great preparation for the career I've had, because, you know, technology is all consuming as an industry, and software development in particular is, you know, it's not a project that you ever finish. So, you know, figuring out how to, you know, pace yourself and work hard, but, you know, also create boundaries for the other things in your life is, you know, it's just something that I feel like my family did a good job of helping me prepare for.
So you mentioned three to four things that you learned in growing up in such a large family. And one was relationship, problem solving, getting to know different personalities, and also negotiation. And you already mentioned one small example. Do you have, I somehow see these four areas also as areas that, you know, are useful in the workplace. Is there a connection between that? And so why you named those four things, you know, as being something that you learn in your family, but also in the workplace?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we do in our industry requires an intense, when it's done well, requires an intense amount of collaboration. It is a team sport. And certainly if you haven't had experience and training and collaboration, you can learn that. And I've coached people who are used to being a lone wolf and just want to go off and create their manifesto and come back and throw it over the wall at people, that they have to learn how to build consensus, listen to other people's ideas, and have that enrich their work. And I think, you know, growing up in a context where I had to learn how to collaborate and, again, compromise and listen to other people's needs, as you do in any large group, you know, like my family, that really set the conditions for me to, to be a person who enjoyed and was very comfortable with close collaboration. And I will say my theater experience was a huge asset to me because of that. It probably made me a good collaborator in the theater growing up in my family. And then my time in the theater really enhanced those skills and, you know, helped me, I think, be even more effective in this work in software, because putting on live theater is like the most intensely collaborative thing that you can do. So sometimes people look back and think, oh yeah, theater major, like that wasn't very useful. And I was like, actually, it's some of my most useful skills, that I got from, producing live theater.
So when you see someone collaborating effectively, what is something that they model if you think about good collaboration? What is something that they do that models collaboration?
I think being excellent at listening, which is really underrated. I think sometimes people in when we talk about leadership talk a lot about, you know, how you communicate and create a vision and, you know, public speaking, and all those things are great, but huge chunk of leadership and also collaboration are about listening, hearing what other people have to say, learning from their perspective. And so I think that's a huge thing. I also think, and it's associated to that listening piece, is admiration and curiosity about other disciplines. So, you know, if I come in and say, yeah, design is the end all be all, I'm sunk even before I start, right? Because design has an incredibly important part to play, but engineering is absolutely critical. And I learned a ton from the engineers that I work with, or the researchers, or the product managers, or the data scientists. And, you know, having some humility about, you know, yourself and your strengths and the areas where you have to grow, listening to other people, and then really being joyous in that collaborative process, I think is a huge part of success.
When you mention listening, how have you, or what advice can you share on how to practice becoming a good listener?
Well, you know, in a very practical sense, there is training you can go through in active listening, which I highly recommend. Every time I go through it, I realize, you know, it's like physical exercise. It's not like you can like get in shape and then stop working out for 10 years. Because guess what? Then you go to lift weights and your muscles are like, no. And I think this kind of training, particular on listening and interpersonal communication and collaboration, is a muscle that you need to continue to exercise through training, through feedback, through working with people who are really good at it. And you know, I mean, there's simple things in listening, like when you come into, for instance, a one-on-one meeting, sometimes you have an urge to tell people, you know, what you think about, you know, the situation, or, you know, you've observed that somebody isn't operating at the level that they normally do, that you enter the conversation and you say, hey, I've been noticing blah, 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 and this is why I think this is happening. Instead of, hey, how are you doing? Is everything going okay? You know, do you feel like you're feeling good about how things are going? And allowing that person to open up in a non-defensive way, and you will often tap into insights that they never would have shared if you had gone in and told them what their own story was. So letting people tell their own story instead of you telling them, I think is a pretty simple example. I also think when you're in the context of asking for feedback, which is something that everybody should be doing all the time, is to check that defensive monster that lives inside of our minds. You know, we all want to be doing a good job, and it's hard to hear when we're not doing things perfectly all the time. Spoiler alert, none of us are. But, you know, to figure out how can we invite that feedback and then let it come to us and just be there and not feel the need to engage and defend and rationalize our way out of it. And it can be hard, but if we don't learn that listening skill and that ability to just hear what's being said, we train people not to tell us the things we most need. So I think, you know, by listening, we learn a lot more than we would by talking in a lot of contexts.
So for people who are less aware of what active listening means and as a difference to regular listening, so how would you explain it to them?
Well, I would say that active listening has to do with, again, the way in which you engage in the conversation and your intent, right, is to really pull that information out of them. It's about your body language and the extent to which you are fully present in, and I know this sounds simple, but it's amazing how many times people don't do this, that you turn off your phone, close your laptop, that you sit facing them and you make eye contact, not in a creepy way, but that it's clear, I am fully present to hear what you have to say to me, and that within reason, like, you can say anything to me and it's a safe place. Like, those are all attributes of active listening. In addition, reflecting back what you've heard from them so that you can ensure that what they intend to communicate to you is what you've heard. So say I give you feedback on this podcast and I say, hey, you know, that question that you asked me, and this is fictional, of course, you know, that made me uncomfortable. And you can say, so what I'm hearing is that question made you uncomfortable. Why is that? You know, so you don't, A, you reflect back to me so you can make sure that you heard correctly and that you don't then try to come to your own conclusions. You dig further. You know, I'm upset about how that meeting went. Tell me more about that. Dig more. Let them kind of come to their own conclusions about things instead of telling them. And it can be a really powerful and empowering way to have a conversation with somebody. And as leaders, we need to be particularly careful about that because our words have a ton of power and weight. And when we tell people the conclusion, they tend to accept it even when it's not the right one.
Yeah, that's a great, great example. I love the reflective part of it. Like what I heard you say is just a super, super powerful way to frame what you didn't say and to make sure that you've fully understood what the other person said. So that's great, great advice. We jump straight into it, into some of the management techniques as well, which is great. And we'll dive more into it. But one thing that I know of your story, which I found really interesting, is that you were born in New York City and grew up in Manhattan or were born in Manhattan, but then you actually went and moved a bunch. And so for people, usually people move to New York City and then they rarely leave. But in your case, it was you left New York City to move into different places. What compelled those moves?
Well, so I was born in Manhattan. We lived right outside in a smallish town in New Jersey. But both my parents are from Astoria, Queens, and so our family center of gravity was in that area. And then, you know, we moved around a lot, in part because, for very practical reasons, at a certain point, my father realized he was going to have 5 kids in college at the same time. And he was like, how am I going to afford this? So we all moved to Wisconsin, where he could send them in state to University of Wisconsin, which is one of the great public universities in the country, for very little money and could afford to pay for all of their university training, which is something that was really important to him and my mom. And and then after a few years, he was like, wow, it's really cold here. And so we were like, oh, getting closer to retirement, maybe we'll move south and get into some more humane weather, which is how we ended up in Tennessee. I'm oversimplifying these moves, of course. But and so I think it was always very family oriented, the motivations, and figuring out a quality of life for himself and my mom and us as a family, that motivated the moves. And so, you know, as a part of that, obviously I had to learn how to like uproot, make new friends, start in a new school, be the new kid. And so that's very intuitive to me. In fact, for a while I, you know, would get this, even as an adult, this like 3 or 4 year itch where I'd be like, oh, I got to get up and move because I've been here for too long. And it's funny because my husband moved around a lot as well. So he had sometimes the same inclinations. And then we had three children and we were like, we can't keep moving around because now, you know, it's good for them to have some stability. So now we've been in California for 10 years, which is the longest time I've ever lived any place, actually, now that I think of it.
Do you feel a niche now?
No, I mean, it's an amazing place to live and work. I do love going back east. We spend a lot of time in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts. And one of the things I love about going there is it's not a place where technology is like a primary industry. And I find that really soothing. I love working in technology and I love the companies that I've worked for. But I love talking to people who do completely unrelated things. And it can be a little exhausting, you know, being in a one industry area. And so I really cherish the time when I get to spend time, you know, even in our other offices in New York or London, where there's so much going on. It's really exciting. And I think, you know, good as designers and just human beings to understand all the other things that are going on in the world other than, you know, high tech.
Do you have currently a topic or theme or discipline that you love spending time thinking and talking about that is totally not related to tech or design?
Well, I think of everything as being related to design. Even sometimes it's bad design, but there's still design involved. I'm really interested in brain science. And I was so sad when Oliver Sacks passed away because I think he's just like truly one of the great humans of all time. When you have somebody who's that brilliant at what they do and they're a gifted storyteller and writer, it's just something people should cherish because there's so much genius out there that gets locked in the genius's brain and no one else can access it, because they can't translate their genius into a way that non-experts can understand. So I've just been listening to a lot of interviews with him and just fascinated by how the brain works, which of course is interesting to me in my work as well from a cognitive, you know, psychology perspective. But I think, you know, my family's been touched by Alzheimer's and, you know, it's, you know, we have learning disabilities and, you know, sometimes, you know, challenges that people go through because of their brain chemistry and the way the brain works. And so that's a topic that both personally and professionally I'm super interested in. I think the other one is something that I've always been interested in. And I actually have a couple of like a niece and a nephew who have gone into this professionally, which is architecture. And I'm fascinated by architecture and also urban planning. Sometimes I think of Facebook as like, we're kind of doing urban planning in some ways because we're looking to construct a really healthy community. And so I think there's a lot of for us to learn from really good urban planning. And so that's something that I've been dabbling in a bit in terms of something that doesn't seem directly related to what I do, but eventually
has
folds
some connection
back in.
Yeah. So what I also liked about your story is that and we talked a little bit at the beginning of it, that was not a choice for one profession or one discipline that you chose at the beginning of your career or before launching your career and to cover your education, but you actually went to NYU into a program that was multidisciplinary. So can you, which I found really interesting because it kind of connects back to what you do today as well. So can you talk a little bit about the decision-making process of choosing that program over any other?
Yeah, it was an interesting path. And I think at that point, they never talked to me about it, but my parents were probably a little bit nervous, like, oh, where's she going to land? But again, gave me the space to pinball around a little bit. After graduating college, I actually went to study in France for a year, and I studied the School of Fine Arts, and I did mostly photography and printmaking, and I really enjoyed it. And when I came back, I thought I was going to do an MFA in photography, and then I started getting interested in film and filmmaking, and I'm still really passionate about filmmaking. If, you know, in another life, maybe I still will be a filmmaker. But I actually, this was back in the day when, you know, you didn't log on to find out about university programs. You actually asked for a catalog to be sent to you with written application materials. And I sent away for the information to apply to the NYU Film School. But it was in a catalog that was all about the Tisch School of the Arts. And I literally just was paging through the book and came across this program that I had never heard of before. And it was called the Interactive Telecommunications Program. And I started reading it and I thought, this is it. This is a program that's at the intersection of design and art and technology, which previously had not been heavily involved or invested in. And I don't have to choose. It was like a program for people who were trying to figure out how all this stuff intersected. And I didn't know about any place that embraced that. I thought there was something wrong with me that I was resisting or nervous about. God, do I really just want to do photography for my whole life? Or do I just want to do filmmaking? Ah, well, here's this place where it's, you know, this collaborative soup of people from all kinds of disciplines trying to figure it out. And while I was there, the graphical browser started coming out. And I mean, it was just like a revolution in, you know, figuring out how to democratize communication systems. Just a fascinating time to be there. But I really stumbled into it. No one in my family or my friends had any idea what I was doing and why. But I thought, you know, this is going to be a really interesting learning experience. I have no idea what I'm going to do coming out of it. But for some reason, I guess I felt like something really interesting was going to happen on the other side. Yeah. And I turned out to be right. That was good.
Yeah, the way you describe your journey sounds very familiar to me. When I graduated from high school and needed to make a decision about what to study, I had the same issue. There were only these catalogs, these brochures you can, you know, go through and then pick your subject and pick your studies. And I felt like I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was a little bit like you, not really knowing and understanding what are these different paths that you can go on. And I ended up choosing, going to law school, which I really hated. And then I went to hotel management school, which I hated too. And I almost became a middle school teacher, which I loved, but I didn't see myself being a teacher. But I had the same feeling of thinking that something was wrong with me. Because, you know, I looked around and all my friends seemed to have figured it out. They really knew what they wanted to do. They left school. They went and, you know, went to med school and became lawyers and doctors and everything. And I felt something was wrong with me. When you think about raising your children in a world that is changing at a faster pace than ever before, with jobs, and you already mentioned this, with jobs that do not exist today. How do you take your own personal story and talk to them about what they can become in their future?
Man, it is so on point, and it's a very astute question, because, you know, whether it's with some of my nieces and nephews who followed a similarly circuitous path in this family that tends to have inertia around more obvious paths of law, medicine, business, and them feeling like, oh, there's something wrong with me. Like, what do I tell my parents? Or even my own kids. You know, my oldest has a lot of different interests. And I think sometimes he thinks, oh, there's something wrong with me because I don't exactly know what I'm going to do. And I'm like, no, that is where the magic is. You know,
how old are your kids? Sorry if I interrupted. How
so,
old are your kids?
No, that's okay. My son is, he'll be 19 this week. And he's a freshman in college. And then my daughters are 16 and 15. So they're really at the point where they're feeling this pressure to know. And this comes from a position of privilege to be able to say this. And I'm very aware of that, but I keep telling them, I'm like, you don't have to know yet. If you do, that's great. And you may change your mind, and that's okay too. There's nothing wrong with thinking that you know and then realizing there's a different path that is not failure, that's success. And you don't have to figure it out. And you know better than I do, in some areas of the world, a kid's 14, 15 years old have to decide what they're going to specialize in. I think, you know, the tradition of liberal arts education is something I really cherish. Like that idea of going to school for 4 years and just studying, as I call it, all the ologies. Psychology, anthropology, physiology, all the ologies. And figuring out, how do these things intersect? Maybe there's this passion I had no idea I had for physics or for music or, you know, whatever it might be. Or maybe I've just stoked a little flame that is going to be something I enjoy for the rest of my life and I don't do it professionally. That's such a gift that you give a human being, is to explore all the amazing things that humans are doing. And, you know, for my own kids and also, you know, for the young people in my broader family, I've really tried to help reduce their anxiety that there's something wrong with them, like you said, or that they should be embarrassed, that they don't have this like immediate answer. Because for some people, it just takes a few years and they're percolating and marinating and, you know, they'll find their path. I really believe that. Again, you know, that comes from a position of privilege because a lot of families don't have the luxury of just being like, oh, see and wait. You know, they struggle to pay for college. And, you know, if there's a lot of financial stress, it makes sense to try to like figure something out so that you can support yourself financially. I just wish that everyone through free university had the opportunity to explore and find out what they're really destined to do, how they can be productive and in society and feel fulfilled personally. Because I think that takes time. Most 16-year-olds will not get it right.
Do you think the system as it's set up today allows for this to happen?
I think for some people it does. Again, I think, you know, private liberal arts schools are extremely expensive. Only a small percentage of families can really access it. And you can get excellent education at many places, and I'm talking specifically about the United States in this context. But I think the cost of higher education is prohibitive for a lot of people, which makes me really sad. And I think there is this pressure to do something very early on, to decide to do something safe and practical. And if that's what your calling is, that's great, that subject matter. But I believe within reason that people end up being much more happy and fulfilled doing something that they love and making less money than doing something where they make more money, but they're, you know, it doesn't feel like it's their calling. And that's hard to know in advance, and hindsight, so is 2020. But I do think that those late high school and college years are just the perfect time for people to, you know, do things that may not make sense on paper and explore things, try new things, and find out where the intersections are that are really interesting to you. Because I think one thing that we've learned, and certainly high tech is a great example, is we don't know where careers and industries are heading. Even 5 to 10 years from now, there are going to be jobs none of us have ever heard of before. And the people who are going to be well prepared to excel in those roles are people who can think at a higher level of like how these things connect. And in addition, to bring together people from different disciplines to solve problems that we have not encountered before. You know, maybe it's working with a biologist and, you know, somebody and an artist and, you know, an engineer. You know, maybe you wouldn't have put those together, but there's going to be a problem that we encounter as a human society that requires those disciplines. And again, that's why familiarity with those domains and a love of collaboration, I think, is really going to be key.
So if you could share some advice on for people who hear this and say, okay, so I understand that our industry or the broader industries or multiple industries that I know today are going to be different or may not exist in the future. How do you, what do you tell people and what it is, what kind of skills they can acquire and develop to be ready for a changing industry or changing landscape or economic landscape that can be ported throughout different contexts?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll echo something that my graduate school mentor, Red Burns, who started the Interactive Telecommunications Program, once said to our class as we were starting. She said, you know, we're not going to teach you how to use any particular kind of software in this program, because every few years the software changes and you're spending too much money to learn how to use a software program. You can do that on your own. You're here to learn how to learn. And I think that is ideally what education provides you, is a framework to say, okay, how do I enter this new domain or this new problem space and learn about it and figure out how to navigate it effectively, so that no matter the situation that I find myself in, I can figure out how to add value. And part of that is figuring out how to absorb a lot of information and synthesize it, how to draw on other people's strengths to collaborate around brainstorming solutions, and then in the case of design, having a solid understanding of what a good, rigorous design process is so that you can work through different kinds of problems. Those are the kinds of transferable skills that you can apply to almost any context, versus I'm going to become a deep expert in this particular aspect of the technology as it stands today. That's great, but if it isn't a part of a larger package, you can start to feel like redundant or outdated in terms of your skill set. So, you know, focusing on that notion of learning how to learn and then really becoming a huge asset to a team as a collaborator is, I think, a way to ensure your relevancy and your value and you know, your ability to kind of move in and between different opportunities.
So I want to take this as a good jumping off point into the broader area of management. I want to make sure that we spend some time on that, because I think if we would take your story and your path, your career, to become a vice president of product design at Facebook, which is one of the, you know, five companies in the world right now that has a huge impact on billions of people. Maybe can you help us understand the path to becoming this to taking on this role, and maybe stop at a few crossroads where throughout your career where you would pause and say, okay, here's where I took decisions, or here's where I took a turn, or here's where I took a risk, or I tried something out that led you on this path on taking on this role at Facebook?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I've already talked about one, which was, well, you know, I want to do photography or filmmaking, which are kind of known quantities. You know, you can think they're either good or bad career decisions, but people know what they are. And then jump into this totally ambiguous space of interactive telecommunications. Man, what the heck is that, right? Following my instinct that there's something interesting going on in this like soup of disciplines mixing together, and quieting that notion of I know what's going to happen at the end of this. And I think that probably speaks to comfort with ambiguity, which I think serves people very well if you can cultivate it. And so looking past that, I think the next big fork in the road was several years into my career, deciding to become a manager, as opposed to what would have been a very valid decision, which is to stay an individual contributor and just kind of work on craft and excelling at that. And as an aside, it's hugely important for organizations to encourage both of these paths, because if all of our most talented people become managers, we don't have anyone left to excel at making stuff.
Can I jump in there? Because this is exactly something that we've dealt with at SoundCloud. So I spent 8 years at SoundCloud, and so I saw the company grow from 7 to 400 people, and this is literally something that we've experienced painfully sometimes, and sometimes a little bit better. But this difference, or this notion, or this idea, and this was probably in my head, but I also saw it in other people's heads around me, is this notion that in order for you to progress in your career, you have to take on a management role. And I think what we did not so well, I would say, at SoundCloud, was to not create a clear distinction between these different roles, because they are roles, and to communicate to people what the differences are and what the expectations are on either side. So what we ended up having is a problem that we had suddenly people who were excellent individual contributors becoming managers and realizing after several months that they were either not good at it or they didn't like it and they wanted to go back and be individual contributors. So how do you, so people listening to this and thinking about advancing your career on either path, on either track, how do you take people's fears that their career can still progress meaningfully?
Yeah. It's such a good question. And I will say that part of the reason this is hard is that the norm in most organizations is that the way that you progress in your career is to become a manager. So there's a good reason that people assume that that's true. But if we understand that in a maker culture like SoundCloud or Facebook, where we're producing things and we want them to be the best of their kind in the world, we have to have a good chunk of our top talent doing that making full time. So how do we deal with this like societal norm and actually wanting to move in a different direction? And I will say that it's not like we always get this perfectly, but I think we've made some principled decisions to try to work against that inertia of, oh, just go into management. One is that I really try to have conversations with people about what their motivations are when they express interest. Hey, I want to become a manager. Oh, cool. Well, tell me about why that is. Like, what's going to change for you? Well, I think I'm going to have more influence. Okay, well, let's talk about how we can expand your influence in your current role and work on that. And this is hard, too, because like you said, sometimes people try it and they don't like it, is to try to remove the stigma between moving back and forth. So we have had people who've had a long, rich, experience as an individual contributor, and then they try management. And that's cool if we coach them through that and realize, actually, I get more satisfaction creating the conditions for other people to be doing great design work than I do myself. That's interesting. Let's create that opportunity for you to try that and see if that hypothesis you have is true. And sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. And the ability to move back with no stigma attached to that is so important, because we also sometimes have managers who've been managing for a long time who say, hey, you know what? I want to get back into the trenches for a couple of years. Can I do that? And the answer, as much as we can, is to say, yes, yeah, let's do that. Let's figure out how you can engage much more directly, get your hands dirty again. And to create that, within reasonable timeframes, that ability to move back and forth so that it's not like it's a one way and that, if you try management and you do poorly, boom, you're gone. Or that if you try it and you do it for a while and then you just decide because you want to go back to making that you can do that too. So I think that notion of let's make sure that there's not like a financial motivation to do it, because that creates the wrong incentives, that you create fluidity between the roles so people feel like they're both really valued and respected and there's not a stigma of moving back and forth. And first and foremost, coaching people through that decision just to make sure that they're doing it in general for the right reasons. Again, it's not like we always get these things right, but there's been a lot of focus and conversation and trying to put the right protections in place so people end up in the place where they're going to be most happy, most fulfilled, and most impactful.
So people who listen to this, they couldn't see your face when you started talking about management, and so your face lit up and your eyes lit up and you started talking about it with passion. Where does this passion for being a manager come from?
I just love working with people. I mean, a huge part of my happiness at work is the people I get to work with and the camaraderie and the sense that we're in this together, whether it's going well or going poorly, and that we'll see each other through. We will rely on each other for feedback and also for assistance when we need it. I mean, that is, you know, we spend an insane amount of time at work, even when we're not like working more than we should. It's like a full-time job means you're spending more waking hours with your colleagues than almost anybody else in your life. And creating an environment where people feel cared for and fulfilled is really satisfying. Because when you care about the mission of what a company is doing, you have to care about the people as much, because, you know, projects and initiatives will come and go, but that glue, that leadership and really thoughtful people management brings to that context is the thing that is going to help us succeed and make the highs even higher and the lows something that we can work through together. So I just, I'm really passionate about it. It's something that I have spent the majority of my career doing. And I love helping people figure out whether, you know, what their path is. And I don't have a bias towards managing or non-managing. I think it's a real gift to engage with people and help them kind of navigate that decision. So yeah, I am really passionate about it because it's really rewarding.
If you could share your top, maybe one, two, three highs of being a manager and the top one, two, three lows of being a manager, what would you say?
I think a high is having somebody who's really struggling but has a ton of potential turn it around, and helping them find their footing and succeeding is awesome. It takes a lot of work and you don't always succeed because sometimes people are just not suited to a particular environment or they don't want to grow or change. And that turns into the lows, right? But the high is helping people evolve and reach potential that they didn't know they had. That is just, I think it's similar to probably what an athletic coach feels when they see an athlete like set a new personal best that they didn't think they were capable of. Like that's enthralling, you know, because you're really witnessing humans achieving potential, which, you know, it's like one of the magical things about being humans is we can kind of set goals and work to achieve them. So that I think is really satisfying. You know, creating a team that does extraordinary work that has really positive impact on the world. Like that's an amazing feeling. And it's a joy to kind of share in the celebration and to feel pride that you've had some part in putting these individual people together into this like cocktail, which is every time you mix people together, you kind of don't know what's going to happen, right? And when you get that mixology right, it's pretty magical. And I think related to that, when you pair people up in ways that they build on each other and make each other better, that matchmaking that happens in the collaborative process, that's really, really satisfying. And then I think on the downside, because I, you know, because I, for instance, at Facebook have, you know, built this team on the business side pretty much from the ground up. There were only a few people when I started, and now there's literally a few hundred. When individuals on the team go through personal tragedy, it's extremely difficult because it does feel like a family. A few years ago, we had a colleague that was a part of my team and reported to me who passed away very suddenly. And, you know, he was a young guy with a young wife and a young daughter. And it was, it reminded everyone in the best way that to just remember that these are not like numbers on a spreadsheet. You know, these are every person who works at the company has a life outside of Facebook and people who love them, and that being able to work with every individual here is a gift and a privilege. And, you know, that we need to be managing the whole person and not just the job that they are hired to do. And so I think when people go through tragedy or a loss, I mean, it's, you know, it's like a, it's a high and a low, right? It's a high to feel connected to a team, and have that, that support and that intimacy of a work family, but it's devastating, when you learn, you know, when something bad happens to a member of your work family. I would also say a low is in our optimism about somebody's potential. If we push them, you know, to the next level, say in a promotion cycle or something, and it's too early and they are not set up to succeed at that level, that feels like a managerial malpractice. It's very hard to coach some people through that because, and this isn't unique to Facebook, it's everywhere, is that people, you know, want to move ahead in their career, and that's totally understandable. But we also want to set people up for success and make sure that they are, you know, in a place where they can do really well. And if we start to promote people based on their potential, but not actually aligned with where they are at and what they can produce, we start to create a really bad situation, where they aren't able to kind of deliver what is being asked of them. And so that doesn't happen very often, but it's part of the reason why we take the performance cycle process and the promotion process so seriously, is, you know, just making sure that people are going to be at whatever point in that career development that and career path where they can truly excel. And I think part of that is, as a manager, differentiating between me as the supportive person that wants everything for you that you want, and looking at the bigger picture of what's actually going to set you up for success. And when you're close to the people that you work with, you know, creating that line can be a little bit tricky. So, I think doing what's best for people, even if it's not what they're specifically asking for, is tough. And when we err on the give people what they ask for and it doesn't work out well, that's really hard.
So a few things to follow up on, or to seg into the next question. And you said earlier that the job of a manager is to create the conditions for other people to do amazing work. And so when you look at your position now, at your role as a vice president, what would you say are the three conditions that you created for yourself to be able to take on a role as a VP? Or in other words, if people are listening to this and say, my ambition or my desire is to become a vice president in my organization, and I'm at the manager or senior manager, maybe at director level, what would you tell them to focus on in order to get there versus things not to focus on?
Well, I can say what's worked for me, which is not going to be universally true, because I think it's incredibly important to have diversity in the way that leaders operate stylistically, because otherwise, you know, we'll end up with no diversity in leadership, and that's devastating to, you know, to teams, to see like creepy uniformity, the way people are communicating and operating. For me, what's worked, mostly because it's created conduits for me to become better at what I do, is aspiring to operate with a lot of authenticity. So the person that I am at work is pretty much the same person I am all, like, generally speaking, and I don't have a different face to the organization or the team. So if they meet with me one-on-one or I'm speaking to them as a group, generally speaking, they kind of get the same vibe. And I think that creates trust, that they can come and talk to me and tell me things, because even though the team is very large, they feel like they know who I am as a person. That can be really hard, because as teams get bigger, leaders become, in perception and reality, less accessible and approachable. And I think that authenticity is an antidote to that. And it's critical, because if you're not accessible and you're not approachable, people will not come and tell you the things you need to hear. And that is a problem for all organizations as they get larger, is leaders are less and less likely to get the feedback they most need about themselves, about the company, about the organization. So I think that authenticity is really important. Connected to that is vulnerability, not trying to communicate some mythology where, like, I'm good at everything, because I'm not. And finding the people in my organization that are good at the things that I'm not that good at. Like, for instance, there's, guy, Tom Hobbs, who works for me, who is like way more of a data cruncher than I am. I do not enjoy spreadsheets. I think intuitively and visually about things. And so I really value his skills in that. And it makes us a stronger team for me to acknowledge that and empower him to serve that role, not just for his area, but the whole organization. And I think that leads to the last thing I would say, which is learning how to delegate effectively, which is an art. And it's an art because it doesn't always go well, you know, like you have to, what I often say is you have to throw people into the deep end, but give them water wings. Do you know what those are? They're the little floaty things, mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to setting people on the stairs. If you've ever taught kids how to swim, the stairs are useless. They never walk off the stairs. Like, why would you? You're like, well, I'm already in the water. Why should I go in where I am out of control versus gently helping them into the deep end with water wings? It's a very different thing. And with delegation, I think that the challenge as a leader is to be comfortable with not everything going perfectly across your team. Because, you know, I had a long-time manager, Andrew Bosworth, who, and I wrote a blog post about this because I thought it was such a great lesson he taught me. He said to me one time, he was like, so what's going off the rails in your team? And I was like, oh, how dare you? Like, everything's perfect.
Everything's fine.
All hospital corners, nothing to see here. I don't think I actually responded that way, but I was like, what do you mean? Like, have you heard something? And he was like, no, I just know, you know, if everything's going perfectly, you're probably micromanaging the team. And if you're pushing authority down to your leaders the way you need to and the way you should and the way they deserve, you know, to have those opportunities, not everything's going to go well. So I better see some things a little bit off the rails. Because if you don't delegate and you operate through micromanagement, you're going to burn out. And people are going to be unhappy because they want to feel authority and control over what they're doing. And so I think that delegation piece, and also hopefully being in an environment where your manager and the organization understands that and doesn't assume that that reflects poorly on you as a leader, that there's some things that are a little off the rails, I think is a really, it's a really great thing to strive for. There's so many benefits to everyone in that ecosystem if you can figure out the art of delegation.
Yeah, and you wrote about this on your Medium channel. I'll link to it in the show notes so people can follow up and go read the piece, which is really, really good. We have to move into the last segment of the podcast. I could talk to you about management and leadership way more. I would have probably another 10 questions around it. So maybe we can do a round two in the future.
Yeah, I would love that.
But for the last segment, these are like some more rapid fire questions. And the good news is of the five that I would ask you, you already kind of pointed to three of those throughout our conversation. So we won't need to get into it. But one that I would like to ask you that I put a circle around it because I want to make sure that I don't forget to ask you this. You mentioned that you have a passion for filmmaking. If you could make a film today, what would be that film?
The first thing that popped into my mind when you asked that question is like an amazing biopic about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's our Supreme Court justice.
Very
and I'm
cool.
Totally obsessed with her. There's this story that I heard about her just really quickly where, you know, she was one of very few women who was in her law class, I believe at Harvard. And she and the two or three other women who were in her class were called up during orientation in front of all the men, and the dean told them that they had to explain and rationalize why they took a man's place in the class. And I don't know, I love seeing the stories of older women who have excelled in male-dominated fields because they powered through so much adversity. And I think we can learn and be inspired so much, even though we're dealing with lots of challenges today. I often refer to them as like badass old ladies. I just love them. And so Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I would love to make a film about her.
That would be a great film. What is one item that you have on your bucket list that you would love to put into a reality?
I think, you know, one thing I would love to do, and I think this is probably a product of me coming from a really large family and totally understandably not getting a lot of one-on-one time with my parents. I mean, I have zero judgment around that because I was just happy to be fed and clothed, right, with 9 kids. But I look at my 3 children and they're growing up so fast. So I have this idea that I want to take each of them on some kind of really interesting international trip, just them and me. And to like have that time for it to just be the two of us. I love family time all together, but I would love to do that. I still have many years to accomplish that. But I think it would be great to focus on individuals instead of group.
How would you negotiate? And this is maybe back to one of the first things you said about learning how to negotiate. And how would you negotiate with your teenagers on where to go?
Oh, I pretty much let them lead the way on that.
Good.
You know,
do you have a sense of where they want to go?
I think so. I think my son would love to go to Tokyo. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about that.
Great.
I think my daughter, she's a writer, so she's really intrigued by Edinburgh because it's a city of such amazing like literature and so many amazing writers have lived there.
That's a great pick.
And then my youngest is Broadway obsessed, so she would probably just say, can't we just go to New York and see shows all week? But I would love to bring her to London, to the West End, and have her see that there's like amazing theater going on, or perhaps another city that has a great theater culture. Actually, let me back up on that. She really wants to go to India. For some reason, she has it in her head that like that's a travel dream for her. So anyway, yeah, there's lots of ideas.
Sounds like a good list of adventures coming up for you in the next few years.
Yeah.
Margaret, this is my last question. And this is the question we ask every guest on the podcast, is if you could give your 14-year-old self surrounded by 808 siblings, a piece of advice, what would be that piece of advice?
Well, it may not be as much an advice, but like something I know now that I didn't know then, which is to just tell my 14-year-old self that I'm dyslexic. And I only found it out a few years ago. And that...
How?
Well, my daughter has dyslexia and it's genetic. So when they do the analysis, they're trying to figure out what the pathway is for where that came from. And it clearly wasn't my husband, who's like the most voracious reader ever. And they asked me, they're like, Margaret, how do you, you know, what was your relationship to reading? And I was like, well, I love stories. Reading, not so much. Like I have a real issue with lots of text. And, but I would tell my 14-year-old self that school is hard because my brain works differently and not because I'm not smart or I'm not working hard enough. Because I told myself that for a long time, that I was like, I'm just not as smart as the other people. And maybe I'm just not working hard. Maybe I don't care. Maybe that's why I'm avoiding reading, is that I don't care. And I wish I had known that, because I probably would have figured out ways around it. And I wouldn't have believed something about myself that wasn't true.
Beautiful. Margaret, you've been very generous with your time today. Thank you so much. I hope we can do this again, because there's so much more to talk about management and leadership. Thank you so much, and all the best to you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Role Models Podcast. If you liked this episode, you can find more interviews like this on rolemodels.co/podcast, on iTunes, on Spotify, on SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you would like to support the Role Models Podcast, you can do that by posting a short review on iTunes or consider becoming a patron on patreon.com/role models. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.